Okay, that should be all right.
Are we recording?
Yep.
Okay. So, you want it on my belt? Okay, we're good?
That's a good eraser.
This is a good eraser. That's a good, a big chunk. Okay.
And we go until what, 11:55, is that right? 5 or 12?
11:50.
Till
10 o'clock, but you can go to 5 o'clock since you started.
Special, we consider it sort of part of our self. It has, throughout history, always been compared to the most complex technology of the time, I suppose, beginning with the ancient Greeks and Romans, who thought the brain was kind of a hydraulic machine, because hydraulics, you know, aqueducts and sewers and things like that were the major technology of the time, and then it became compared to timepieces and the early Middle Ages, when clocks and fancy watches were put together and get people to church on time and start the madness of appointments and schedules and deadlines and things like that. So then it was a clock-like work. And then in the Industrial Revolution, it became a kind of a machine, a complicated machine of some sort, powered in various ways. And then, of course, more recently, the computer has been a sort of analog for the brain. And now, I guess, we think of it as the Internet is somehow or another like the brain, or the brain is like the Internet. So every culture tends to compare the brain to the most complicated thing around at the time. And there's both some truth and falsehood in that. The truth of that is, yes, it probably is the most complicated thing around at the time. The falsehood is it's not really like any of those things. It's not hydraulic. It's, although it does have some hydraulics in it, to tell you the truth, and we'll talk about those today. It's not really a timepiece, although it has a little bit of those works in it. It's certainly a powered machine. And it does computations in the way a computer does, and maybe the network is the closest thing we have to it, because we think of it as some sort of a network of cells working together. So none of those are a completely accurate description. Indeed, we have no completely accurate description, in case you thought you were going to get one today. I don't want to disappoint you later on. I might as well disappoint you early on. What we're going to talk about today is not so much maybe the brain, as it were, but the works of the brain, the pieces, the parts, and the mechanisms by which this bowl of jelly up here, this 3.5-pound bowl of mush, seems to get things done somehow or another. So we're going to sort of pick apart the cellular and molecular elements of the brain, of the nervous system, a little bit more than, say, the psychological view of the brain as a whole. We do that for a couple reasons. One is this is a biology class, and the other reason is we know a lot more, oddly enough, about some of the details and the mechanics and the works of the brain than how it necessarily works in a larger way. Okay, so... So what can I tell you about as a kind of an introduction? One of the remarkable things about the brain as an organism is a tremendous diversity of cells and cell types. Unlike most of the other organs in your body, I mean, a liver cell is kind of a liver cell is a liver cell, but that's not so much true of brain cells. They come in a wide diversity of types, both what we might call pharmacological types or chemical types, molecular types. That is, they express different sorts of genes and they make different chemicals. They have different structures. And they have different functions. There are a few major types, but we'll talk about those, and within that I'll simplify that a little bit more, even to tell you the sort of major components of brain cells, but nonetheless, tremendous diversity of cells. They are among the smallest cells in your body, the granule cells of an organ called the cerebellum, that cauliflower-looking thing attached to the back of the brain. The granule cells, of which there are billions in the cerebellum, measure only a few microns in diameter, and they're also the largest cells in your body. So there's a cell that whose cell body, whose soma is right around here in the middle of your back, but it sends an extension, what we call an axon, we'll go through all this, but it sends a sort of a long extension down into your big toe. So if you wiggle your big toe at the moment, that cell is what's active. And that extension goes, well, some of you, maybe 3, 4, 5 feet. So you have a cell that's at least 5 feet long. Blue whale, that cell is almost 60 feet long. So that's quite a long cell, quite a big cell. And so both the smallest and the largest cells. Sorry. Touch screen, right. Audio controls, lavalier, I'll just take... Okay. Is that better now? You can't hear me? Still hear me?
No.
What have I done now?
Oh, I turned it off.
Right. Now you can hear me. About the brain that's a little different than many other organs in the body. It retains this quality of what we call plasticity. So this is a word you hear used kind of often with the brain, and it's kind of funny because maybe it has a different meaning in neuroscience. Plasticity means moldability, that it changes, that it develops, that it's influenced by not only genes, development, but by the environment. And so every brain in the room here is a little bit different because of the specific environment and context in which it developed and grew up and continues to develop and grow up. And so you retain this kind of plasticity, which means that you can modify activity as a result of experience. That's not as true in other organs of the body. It's a little bit true, but nowhere near as much as the brain. Despite this kind of plasticity, it's also the most developmentally sophisticated, if you will, part of the brain, a part of the body, in that brain cells are very highly developed. They're not able to reproduce. They don't regenerate. They get stuck in the geo cycle, cell cycle. And so you're born, basically, with all the brain cells you're ever going to get. That's why babies' heads are so big. So you have almost all the brain cells you'll ever get the day that you're born. In fact, a significant number of them die off in the first few weeks of life in a process known as pruning, which is very important to development. And that's it. You don't really make new brain cells like you make new skin cells or new liver cells or things like that. So they're a highly differentiated type of cell that are unable to reproduce new cells. This is, of course, a bit of a problem because if you have a pathology or injury and you lose some set of brain cells, you don't get replacements. I mean, there's a lot of them, so it's not such a big problem often, but it can turn into one. So the main function of all of this business up here, of course, is information transfer and signaling. The basic circuit is that there's some stimulus outside that comes in that you detect in some way or other through these little holes in your head mostly. I mean, everything you know about the world in some way you know because of these little holes in your head and the stuff that comes into them and the specialized tissues that exist in the cavities inside those little holes that are sensitive to various sorts of physical energy, light, or sound, pressure, chemicals, so forth and so on, a touch, your skin. And this is kind of what comes into the brain, and so this is what you know about the world. The brain processes this in some way, in some complex way, presumably, and then there's behavioral output. So we have these two systems. We have the sensory system bringing input, we have some integrator in the middle, and then we have a motor system that outputs behavior, essentially. It gets us moving around. The important thing is that you want it to be fast, faster than the thing that's chasing you down the street that would like to eat you for dinner, for example. It has to be at least that fast. It needs to be reliable because you don't want to run away from the wrong sorts of things or run to the wrong sorts of things. It needs to work, as you'll see, over a fairly long distance. For example, the distance from here to your big toe. And it needs to be, what did I say, reliable, specific. We'll talk about specific in a minute. So there are two main divisions of the nervous system, just a sort of an overall view of it. We call them the peripheral nervous system, or the PNS, and the central nervous system, or the CNS. We're going to talk mostly about central nervous system in this class, but it's a not entirely artificial distinction, but one that's commonly made. So the central nervous system includes your brain and everything inside your spinal cord, everything inside your backbone. So the brain and spinal cord are basically the central nervous system, and everything else is the peripheral nervous system, which includes most of your sensory systems and most of your motor neurons, the things that run your muscles, are the peripheral nervous system. There are exceptions to that. The retina of your eye, for example, is considered part of the central nervous system, even though it's sort of stuck outside the skull, but it's important to be there, of course, at least in blood. But it's actually a central nervous system type of tissue, embryonic, and so forth. So there are always exceptions, but basically there are these two major divisions. All right, so the functional unit of this whole thing is a particular cell, which we call the neuron. Oops, I see, this is going to be one of those tricky boards. The neuron, which simply means a brain cell. And they come in, as I said, many flavors and great diversity. There are a large number of them. The human brain has somewhere in the order of 10 to the 11th or 100 billion of these brain cells. The other major type of... So the 10 to the 11th of them come in a big diversity, a wide diversity. They weren't always recognized as individual cells. The brain was lagged behind the idea of cell theory, which in the middle of the 1800s was sort of took over biology, the notion that the whole organism is really made up of these individual small units called cells that are both specialized in certain ways and make us up. The brain was thought for a long time to not be so much individual cells, but rather a kind of a network, a reticulum, as it's sometimes called. And it wasn't until the work of a famous neuroscientist named Ramon y Cajal in Spain that this idea changed. And Cajal used a technique called the Golgi technique. The Golgi technique was invented by an Italian named Camillo Golgi. The technique is still in use today to some extent. And it's a kind of an interesting lesson in science and how you make progress. So here's the thing about the Golgi technique. The Golgi technique uses silver impregnation. It uses a kind of funny bunch of chemicals. Silver impregnation in a hardened bit of tissue that's specially prepared. And when you use this technique, what it does is it stains about 1% of the neurons in a piece of tissue. So you take a brain, you slice a piece of tissue out of it, you prepare it in the correct way, and you put this silver nitrate material on it, and about 1% of the neurons in that tissue turn black. So the two interesting things here, it's only 1% and it seems to be a random 1%. You can never predict which neurons are going to turn black and which ones are not. So 1% of them take this stain up, produce this chemical reaction, and turn completely black. Not only that, whichever one takes it up will turn completely black throughout its entire cell, all the way, if it's the one in your spinal cord, all the way down to your big toe, that one will be black. So this is important because when you have 10 to the 11th neurons packed into a brain and you try and use some typical stain on it in order to see the cells, you don't see anything. You just see a big black mess. Because if all the cells are stained, you can't detect anything in the individual. But if 1% of the cells are stained, then you can see that one, then you can see those cells in relief, as it were. And you can see them all the way along all the processes.
Is that probably possible to work on neurons?
Yes.
So how do they know that?
Right, so the question is it only work on the brain, and how do they know it's staining individual cells? We didn't know that to begin with. Well, you don't, and it was a raging controversy. In fact, Golgi never believed that it was staining individual cells. He believed in the reticular theory. Because what happens is when you stain a cell and you see what the structure looks like, you have sort of a handout that shows a vague diagram of it, you see that they branch out into these ever finer and finer processes, and then they make contact with each other. But it was never clear whether they were more like the vascular system, where the processes from the arteries get finer and finer and finer into these little capillaries and finally become the venous system. But it's all connected. It's all one big connected network. They're not separated. It was Cajal who recognized that once he could see these Golgi stains, that these were indeed individual cells. But some of them were so big, you know, in a microscope, especially the microscopes of those days, you could see the cell body and you could see some of the processes coming off it, but they would go off the out of the field of view of the microscope, you run the slide this way, they still go on and on and on, and they go right off the edge of the slide. So you never, almost always couldn't tell where the beginning and end of the cell was. It was Cajal's insight, however, that showed, and his ability to show that these were really individual cells making connections. And part of it was just really a question of technique. This guy had a brilliant capability. He was trained as an artist originally, but then became a scientist. And of course, there was no photography in the day. So there are two massive volumes of Cajal's work, which we still use in the laboratories today. He went really right through the whole nervous system and made these absolutely exquisite drawings. You can go online and look at the Cajal Institute in Madrid and see some of these things, and they're absolutely remarkable, all done basically by eye. And it was Cajal who not only posited what we now call the neuron theory, which is that neurons are individual cells, but also he suggested two important things about them. One is he had what he calls the law of dynamic polarization. I'll explain this in a minute. And also a second one, which is the law of specific connectivity. So let's see what you saw in this. Second type of cell in the brain, which we're not going to talk about here, and that second type of cell, just for completeness, here a little box here. These are called glial cells. Glia is Greek for glue, and glial cells for a long time were thought to be largely just the stuffing, the packing. There are somewhere between 5 and 10 times as many glial cells as there are neurons, in fact. So maybe as many as 10 to the 12 glial cells. And this is a cell type that provides both what we call trophic and tropic and structural support for neurons. So they regulate the solutions surrounding the neurons, they move waste away, they bring nutrients in, and they also provide a kind of a structural support so that the brain has a shape, and they stick together in ways that stick to neurons in ways that are important for many functions, are only now beginning to recognize actually the very area of active research. For a long time, LEOs were largely ignored, just kind of considered the stuff. We now realize that's probably not the case, but they're not so active in signaling, and they have no long-distance capabilities. They don't send information around. So they're largely a supporting type of cell. We'll come back to them once or twice, but for the most part, we're not going to worry so much about LEO. All right, so let's have a look at these neurons. I'm going to try and make this drawing so we can get that. That suggests to show you how this biology works. So there's this great diversity of these neurons, but there are some common structural elements that you can see from one to the other. So first of all, they all have a soma or cell body. That's where the nucleus and all the other housekeeping stuff that the cell needs to do. Now, these cell bodies, as I said, some of them are quite small. They can be just a couple of microns in diameter. Some of them are 20 or 25 microns in, quote, diameter. They come in a variety of shapes, something like that. Extending from the cell body are these protoplasmic extensions called dendrites. And this comes from the word for tree, and we often call it dendritic tree, because these expand off the soma just like a tree. And some of them can be quite extensive. I think there's some interesting pictures in the book that will show you. They can go for quite some distance, and they can branch extensively or not much at all. But they branch like a tree in the sense that there's a kind of a wider trunk, and every time they branch, they get a little thinner and a little thinner and a little thinner. So they really do just look like very much like a tree or a root system, something like that. These are the dendrites. Then there's one extension that's a little different than the other ones, and that's the axon. And that comes off, can come off anywhere in the cell. And it's the one that travels the longest distance. And it's somehow different from the other one. So I should say the dendrites and the soma, the plasma membrane, is one continuous plasma membrane. You can actually think of the dendrites as an extension of the cell. And indeed, one of the things they do is they significantly increase the area, the cell surface area of the cell, by doing all this branching. So that enables them to contact more things and have more things contact them, but in general it increases the surface area of the cell. And they're more or less continuous with the soma. The axon's a little different. If you look at the axon, if you looked at its membrane, you see there are different kinds of lipids in the plasma membrane of the axon, and there's specific sorts of proteins stuck in that lipid that are different than other ones. The axon also, it also can branch, but when it branches, the branch that comes off is exactly the same diameter of the rest of the axon. So it doesn't matter how many times it may branch, it always, here, this went up. You would see branches, so it is, pardon the phrase, isodiometric. That is, usually the same diameter. They're usually quite thin, only a couple of microns in diameter, but they don't branch in the same way that a tree branches. Finally, the end of the axon is something called the synaptic bouton, which is French for button. So, what can I tell you? I didn't make these names up. So this is a specialized ending of the axon. And it's this ending here that creates what we call the synapse. The synapse is a kind of funny thing because a synapse is maybe the most important structure in the brain, but it's actually just a space. There's nothing in the synapse because it just goes to the dendrite of the next cell. So this is a sort of a dendrite that's going off to get another cell body over here, shaped it. Yeah, so there can be multiple synaptic endings on a cell, depending on how the axon branches, and every one of them is making some target here in what we call the synapse, and that's the connection between two cells. So, for example, if we look for this cell, some incoming axon from another cell is doing this, or this, And there are cells that have up to 100,000 of these synapses being made on their cell body and on their dendritic tree. So all over the place. So axons from as many as 100,000 other cells may be coming to a binge on this cell here and making these synaptic connections. Yeah. Will it connect? So you're going to have, we always thought, it used to be thought that they were primarily from axons on the dendrites. And I'll show you that sort of Cahal's law. We now know that that's not necessarily true. You can have synapses directly onto the cell body. It's not much more either. So you can have synapses directly onto the cell body, what are called axosomatic synapses. You can have axodendritic synapses. They're the most common. You can even have axoaxonic synapses. So it is possible for another cell to synapse directly onto the axon of the cell. You know, it's much less common, but it's not unheard of. And it turns out where you place these synapses will have more or less influence on the activity of the cell receiving them. So that's actually important, it turns out. But in general, you find that most of the synapses come from one cell onto the dendrites of another, from the axon of one cell onto the dendrites of another. And this is part of Cahal's two formulations. So the law of dynamic polarization refers to the fact that these cells have a polarized structure. That is, they're not just a round cell. They have a top, a bottom, a back, a front, whatever you want to call it. So if you start at the dendrite, information tends to come in the dendrite, into the soma, and then out the axon. So you have all these inputs through the dendrites into the cell where it integrates some set of information, whatever all these inputs are, and then it makes some output, which it sends down the axon. It transfers the information. So the information flows largely in one direction, in dendrites, through soma, down the axon, and then to the next cell, where it does the same thing, into a dendrite, through the cell body, down the axon, and off to another cell. Now, obviously, it's more complicated than that because it's this network of multiple inputs everywhere, but that's the general flow of information. And that's this notion of dynamic polarization, polarized meaning that there's directionality. The other notion was that these neurons are connected up in some specific way. That if they are not a reticulum, a net, where they just sort of one flows and one melds into another, but there are specific connections known as synapses. We'll talk about synapses right next time. But that they're not just randomly sort of a big mush. There are specific connections, and there are specific places where those connections are made, and there are specific structures that are those connections, the idea of synapse. There are in the human brain something close to 10 to the 14th of these synapses. 10 to the 11 cells, 10 to the 12 glial cells, and we have about 10 to the 14th synapses. So the numbers are big. Yeah. So the question is, is it always between, I'm not sure I'm the question, is it always between two specific cells? No, so these could be other cells out here.
Could one of them affect more than one?
No, typically a synaptic bouton makes one synapse. So as we'll see next time, there are very specific structures here and here that make this synapse. And then there's this space between the two cells as well. But it's a very specific set of structures. Now, they can be made in brain, but part of the plasticity of the brain is that these synapses are not necessarily permanent. So this synapse may be here for a while. If you don't use it, it'll retract. It'll go away. Or if you use it a lot, maybe it'll attract the second one next to it that strengthens it itself. Yeah. Not through synapses. So glia do communicate to the neurons, but not through synapses. Not through these sorts of synapses. Yeah. So it just kind of talks to itself and nobody else. Yes, so there are things, there are structures like that. I mean, here's the thing. So, and I'm happy to have as many questions as you want to ask me, but everything you can dream up, it's in there somewhere. I mean, you know, it's a billion years of evolution. So yes, there are cases of that. They're a little bit rare. There's sometimes things called autosynapses. So sometimes you want to monitor the feedback. You want to monitor how active a particular synapse is. And one way to do that is to have a kind of auto-feedback onto that. There are all kinds of cognitive synapses. We'll talk about them to some extent next time. I won't be able to get through all of them. You can have a whole course on synapses. So just to give you an idea, though, about how this works out. So it wouldn't be so intuitively obvious how important these axons and dendrites are. But about 99% of the cytoplasm in the cell is found in dendrites or axons. And about 99% of that is found in the axons, which are these very thin cables. And because they run such long distances, they have the bulk of the cytoplasm in the cell actually is found in the axons. And it's very specific cytoplasm. Things run up and down it. There are microtubules inside of it. And things send out the cell to these long terminals far away. Chemicals that produce things like that, proteins and so forth, have to be supplied way out there. So that's half the trick of running a brain, actually, is making sure that all the proteins that are made by the genetic machinery in the soma get out to the axon, the ends of the axons, and even the dendrites. Okay, so we've been talking about the signal, this idea of information being transferred down in a particular direction, jumping across the synapse, continuing on to the next cell, but then the question is what exactly is this signal? And the signal, it turns out, the signal that the brain uses, as it turns out, is something called membrane potential.
Membrane potential.
So, I'm going to say something important now. Not that the other stuff hasn't been, but this is particularly important because if you don't get this, I'm just going to confuse you the whole rest of the time, which I may do anyway. I may do that anyway. If you don't get this, you'll definitely be confused. The word potential has turned into a kind of a physiological word, but it is exactly equivalent to the word voltage. So for whatever reason, physiologists, and particularly neurophysiologists, tend to use the word potential rather than voltage. It's a bit of an older word, but they tend to use the word potential instead of voltage. But it's the same thing. And worse than that, they switch back and forth for no apparent reason most of the time between the words of potential and voltage. But I want you to understand that they mean exactly the same thing. So I also will slip into this ugly habit, which I can't help because it's how I learned it all, of flipping back and forth between potential and voltage. And I just want you to understand, again, carefully, they are exactly the same thing. All right? So what does it refer to, this idea of a membrane potential? Well, the voltage result is the result of separating two charges that like to be together instead. So you do some work to separate these two charges, and that work can be recovered, and it's measured as a voltage. All right, it's just like the voltage in the wall that runs electricity, or the voltage in various devices out there that runs it. So you can use voltage to do work because you use work to get the voltage to begin with. It happens by the separation of charge, and a membrane voltage, or a membrane potential, is the result of separating charge across the plasma membrane so that the amount of charge inside and the amount of charge outside are unequal in some way. Okay? So in the case of, always in the case of voltage, because it is a kind of a potential energy, you always have to measure it between two points. So normally you would say voltage is such and such with respect to some other point. All right. Now, typically we use ground as the other point. So when I say the wall plug has a voltage of 110 volts, that means it's 110 volts comp- compared to or with respect to ground, which is always considered zero. But normally you have to measure between two points. We just understand that usually that second point is zero unless it's specified as ground. The same thing is true in physiology. We measure a voltage between two points, and the convention is, and it's conventional because it physically works this way, that we measure voltage with the inside of the cell with respect to the outside. Because outside the cell is just your body fluid, and it's at ground, it's at zero. Otherwise, we'd all be sparking away here, right? And we're not. You have to turn the lights out. So, since we're at ground, our bodies are basically at ground, it's the inside of the cell with respect to the outside. So if I say membrane potential of this cell is minus 60 millivolts, I mean inside the cell it's minus 60 millivolts with respect to outside the cell. But that's just a convention. We get that straight, and we're going to say it again. Okay? You can measure membrane potential by using a device called an electrode. So if you have a smaller model of a brain cell here. So, if you have a cell here, dendrites disappearing off there and axon disappearing up here, you can use a device called a microelectrode. One of the important developments in the history of neuroscience. Now, Cajal did all this great stuff with the Golgi stain, but it was all anatomy. It's all structure and anatomy. Now you want to know something about function, about what these cells are doing, and you wind up with something called the microelectrode. The microelectrode is a very thin glass capillary, and if you hold it over, used to be, if you hold it over a flame, it would soften up, and you could pull it and pull it and pull it, and then it would finally break. And it would break in such a way you get a thinner and thinner and thinner sort of point. And there would be an opening, and that opening would be about 1 micron, 1 millionth of a meter in diameter. Now we can ask your machines to make these things. But basically they look the same. So it's this glass capillary with a 1 micron opening. So it's open. And you can sort of shove this thing into the cell. And because it's such a thin piece of glass, you kind of wiggle it around and you bang on the table and you do all kinds of things like that. And it gets into the cell, and then the plasma membrane closes around it, and everything seems to be more or less kosher. More or less. So you fill this electrode with a solution, a salt solution, usually that has ions in it, potassium and sodium and various sorts of sacred salts. And then you stick an electrode, what's called an electrode, a silver wire inside of that. And then you connect this to an amplifier. And when you do that, you can read off the membrane voltage, which we're now calling voltage and V sub M. So it's actually pretty straightforward electronics, to tell you the truth, once you get the hang of it. One of the pleasures of working in the nervous system, I have to say, is that it works electronically. There's a value to the fact that the nervous system, the neurons, have an electrical component, because our technology is really designed to measure electrical events, much better than chemical events, for example. So I can measure electrical events in a microsecond, or now even a nanosecond range. Things that change at nanosecond rates, I can measure with electrical equipment. I can measure millivolts, I can measure tenths of millivolts, I can measure microvolts, even the microvolts probably. I can measure picoamps, which are current on barely a few ions going one way or another, can be measured electronically. You can't do this with chemistry. You know, chemistry is swash stuff back and forth. And you kind of measure mass action and all that. You never get to single molecules or anything like that. So electronics is very nice in the nervous system because it works in real time at a very high level of blood. So when you stick one of these microelectrodes into a cell, what you find is that indeed it is negative inside with respect to outside. And typically, depending on the cell, it's somewhere between minus 50 to minus 90 millivolts. Millivolts, now that's thousands of a volt. But this is a small number, right? I mean, even your iPhones or recorders or whatever run on these, you know, 1.5 volt batteries. That's 1.5 volts, that's 1500 millivolts. These things are less than 100 millivolts. But it's substantial because they're very small things, these cells. So this is the kind of electrical voltage that develops inside the cells. So how do you get this electrical bolt? Well, in electricity, in physics, electricity, the kind of electricity that's in the wall, we use electrons. But in biology, when I'm doing an electron, the charge carriers in biology are instead ions. So these are salts that dissolve. Basically, the major ions are potassium, sodium, calcium, to some extent, diamond, and on the negative side, chloride, which is a negative ion. So these are the charge carriers that we're interested in biology, physiology. Because they're part of the solution that cells are bathed in, that are inside the cells, but they have charge, so they can carry current and they can create voltages. All right, so how do they do that? So in order to do this, remember I said that you have to maintain some sort of an asymmetric distribution of ions across the membrane. You have to separate charge across the membrane in order to get a potential. So one of the ways cells do this is indeed to pump ions back and forth so that there's an asymmetric distribution. So typically, I'm just going to use a big round thing for a cell now because I'm tired of drawing out this stuff. So typically, you have a very high concentration of potassium inside cells and a very high concentration of sodium outside cells. Inside, you have low concentration of sodium and outside, a low concentration of potassium. I guess if you so high potassium inside, low sodium inside, just the opposite outside. High sodium outside, low potassium outside. You also have anions of some sort or another. So remember, these have a positive charge on them. An anion, let's say it's chloride, or it could be protein. So proteins carry a lot of negative charges all around them. Amino acids and things like that. But there's, so there's significant anionic charges, negative charges inside. And here you have sodium. So there are lots of these anions, and you have a couple of cations, positive ions. The same thing goes on out here, mostly the chlorides. Okay, so you have this asymmetric distribution. I could actually give you some numbers. So, for example, here's sodium, here's potassium. Just use these two. Here's inside, and here's outside. So sodium inside the cell is about 10 millimolar, and outside the cell it's about 150 millimolar. Potassium is just about the opposite. Inside the cell it's about 140 millimolar, and outside it's something like, actually about 5 millimolar outside. And then there are a few other ions like calcium and so forth, even this whole even up the mathematics, so that the outside, the amount of positive charge outside, the amount of positive charge inside is actually the same. So this doesn't really get you a voltage just yet, right? You have an asymmetric distribution of ions, but there's no asymmetric distribution of charges. You have just as much positive charge inside the cell as you have outside the cell. So there's no difference across the membrane. So now you have to play a little trick. The second critical thing to get these voltages, you have to have what's called asymmetric distribution is one thing. Asymmetric distribution. And the second thing you need is something called selective permeability. This is the real trick. Now, I bet you guys have already talked to some extent about compressible membrane potential and ion channels and things like that. So, but I'm going to go over it again anyway, because I know what I heard is about the third time or so. So it always seems to be good to hear it a couple of times, and I'm sure I'll talk about it slightly differently than we've talked about before. So, all right, so selective permeability. And the way we get selective permeability is with these proteins called ion channels, which we'll talk about in a moment. So ion channels sit in the membranes of cells, and they have this ability to be selective about what ions pass through the zone. So let's imagine now that in this cell, we have these ion channels. Remember that the plasma membrane, being a lipid, is a very good insulator. Charged particles, such as ions, cannot get across the plasma membrane because of its lipid quality. So it's like the rubber around the water. But if you poke holes in it with these ion channels and you leave these water-filled pores, and you put some sort of a selectivity filter on them. I know I'm talking magic now, but actually all these things really exist. I'll explain it to you in a bit. So imagine now a hole that's been poked in the membrane. It's filled with water, so it's a passageway for ions to move through it. And somehow or another it's selective. So you can imagine, let's say, it really looks, you know, like that and that. Okay. And that only potassium ions can fit through that little channel. Sodium ions are too big. I mean, that's one way to make a selectivity filter. In fact, that's one way selectivity filter. Okay, so now you have a cell that's permeable only to potassium. So let's think about what happens here. Let's do it qualitatively first, and then we can actually maybe think about it more quantitatively. So what happens? So you have inside the cell, you have a high concentration of potassium, and outside the cell you have a low concentration of potassium. So initially, what's going to happen? Potassium ions are going to find it kind of crowded in this urban interior of the cell, and they're going to think, why not diffuse out of here and move to the suburbs, where there's lots more room for potassium ions, right? So out they go. So they begin flowing down their concentration gradient from inside the cell to outside the cell. And the potassium ions begin moving out of the cell. Now, as they do so, however, they are leaving behind uncovered anions. So initially, this is all equal in there, right? There's just the same number of positive ions as there are anions. But if a few potassium ions are going to leave because of the diffusion, because it's crowded in there and empty out here, then they're going to leave behind them some uncovered anions. And so the cell is going to become more negative inside. You're going to have an excess of anions inside the cell versus outside. And so it's going to become more negative. So what's that going to do to the potassium ions? Well, now the potassium ions will slow down a bit, right? Because, first of all, it's getting less crowded in here because some of them have diffused out. But more importantly, there's some more available dance partners in here, right? I mean, now there are all these extra anions, positive potassium ions would like to hang out with. And so there are extra anions. So now it becomes sort of more attractive for potassium ions to stay inside the cell rather than diffuse down its concentration gradient. Even though there is still a significant concentration gradient, that's now being opposed by the electrical forces. So if these things weren't charged, if the potassium ions didn't have a charge on them, they would just keep flowing out of the cell until there was an equal concentration of potassium on either side of the membrane, and that would be the end of it. But because they have a charge on them, they're affected not only by diffusional forces, but also by electrical forces. And so at some point, they'll stop diffusing out of the cell. And they'll reach what we call an equilibrium. And that equilibrium will be reached at some voltage. At some point, it'll be negative enough inside the cell that it's more attractive for potassium ion to stay put than it is to flow down the concentration gradient. And with the numbers I've given you here, as I'll show you in a moment, you can plug this into a formula, that most typically occurs at around minus 90 millivolts. So when it gets to be minus 90 millivolts inside the cell, potassium ions find it more pleasurable, more attractive, more interesting, whatever, to stay inside than to move outside. And you now reach this equilibrium. And that equilibrium is between diffusional forces in one direction and electrical forces in the other direction. So that's the qualitative thing. I mean, that's kind of the description of how this goes. Make sense so far at all? You okay with this? All of a sudden, I'm not getting any questions. That worries me. But, yeah. Yes, so this is true. This is true this minus 90 millivolts is true given these concentrations, especially for potassium, this particular distribution here. If it was different, then this equilibrium would be reached at a different voltage. Concentration difference. Alright, so the gas constant is really a kind of an idealized way of describing the activity, if you will, the force of diffusion. So it's related to the concentration, I guess you call it. It's sort of the energy of the ionic solution, is the gas constant. It tells you how molecules are bouncing off of each other and so forth. The temperature, of course. The higher the temperature, the greater sort of weights the gas constant. The higher the temperature, the more molecules are bouncing around, and the faster diffusion will occur. The concentration here, we take the logarithm of the concentration, because this is, we divide here, because this is equivalent, really, right, to the log of C2 minus the log of C1. So we're looking at two compartments. In this case, C2 is inside with respect to outside. So C2 is this and C1 is this. Okay? And we use natural logarithms because diffusion is an exponential process. So this describes diffusion as a difference in concentration between two compartments. Okay? So that's the simple part of the diffusion. Now we can look at the same thing. We can look at the work that's done by the electrical force involved. And this is described even more simply as this. Z is the valence. So for potassium or sodium, it's just 1, and it doesn't count. For calcium, it would be 2. For chloride, it would be -1. But since we're talking right now about potassium, it's just 1. So we really can kind of ignore it. F is the Faraday. And it's kind of the electrical equivalent, if you will, of the gas constant related to the electrical energy of the solution. And E is the E is also a term we use for voltage. So E is the what's called the equilibrium potential or the equilibrium voltage. And it's kind of analogous to the concentration terms. We're just going to tell you about the separation of the particles, of charged particles. All right, so we have two descriptions. We have a chemical description of what's going on, and we have an electrical description of what's going on. At equilibrium, these two things are simply equal to each other. Because what I've said before is that chemical diffusion, the diffusional forces for the pressure on the ion to go out is exactly equal to the electrical force holding the ion. So at some point, the two of them become equal. And then this then becomes what? C. E equals C2 over C1. And this can all be simplified. What we really want to solve for is E. We want the chemical, we want the electrical equilibrium. This equilibrium potential here. So we solve for E. This can be very easily simplified, believe it or not. So this is a very important equation here, actually. I guess we should pause for a moment. So this equation here is known as the Nernst equation. And it is sort of, for physiologists, kind of the E equals MC squared of physiology. So it really has a tremendous amount of explanatory power. It tells you that the voltage, the equilibrium potential, the voltage at which these two forces are equal, can be described by this simple phrase. And it will actually give you a number. If you plug in the two concentrations, if you plug in the numbers 140 and 5, millimolars here, and then do all these numbers here, you could get this out very easily. In fact, all these numbers here can, believe it or not, this is going to seem ridiculous, be reduced to 25 at room temperature. So RT over ZF, if the valence is 1, talking about potassium, and the temperature is room temperature. Remember, R and F are constants, so it's the number 25. It's going to get even simpler, believe it or not. So this just equals 25. And then if we change from natural logs to the log base 10, which makes it easier to work in general, then you just have to multiply by 2.303. So if you multiply 25 times 2.303, you get 58. So what you're going to get is the E for some I is equal to this times the log of C2 over C1. And this is the sort of simplified version of the Nernst equation for most physiological experiments. Yeah?
Yeah,
but
if you want to
expand
it.
Have I got it converted? Do that later. Yes, you're right. Sorry about that. C1 is inside. Correct here, this is the way it goes here. So you have this magic number 58. For those of you who are Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fans, you know that magic number, what's the answer? The universal question, I think it's 42, but actually it should have been 58 in my opinion. So 58. So somehow there's this magic number 58, times the log that is based on regular logarithm of the concentration difference simply gives you the equilibrium potential. And indeed, if you work this out, if you go through these numbers on a calculator, you'll see it will come out to about minus 91 millivolts. So the potassium equilibrium potential, we call it, so or E sub K, is equal to about minus 91 millivolts. So we stick an electrode. We set these concentrations up, okay, around the cell. We know that that's about the correct concentrations for inside a cell. We put a solution together for 5 millimolar, and then we stick an electrode, one of these electrodes, in the cell, and indeed we record a membrane voltage of minus 90 millivolts, because this cell is permeable only to potassium. So we look at the voltmeter there. It says minus 90 millivolts. It says that for a while, like an hour or something. Get kind of bored, so we decide to go out and have lunch. So we go out and have lunch, and we come back, and we look at the voltmeter. It still says minus 90 millivolts. So we watch it for the afternoon. We know where we go about there. Come back, check at night. It's still minus 90 millivolts. Come in the next day. It's still minus 90 millivolts. Indeed, it will be minus 90 millivolts forever, because it's an equilibrium. Okay? So as long as you don't have evaporation or things like that, of course, you'll have a situation where it really remains at minus 90 millivolts forever. It's an equilibrium condition. As long as you set it up correctly to begin with, when you say symmetrical concentration and a selective permeability, then you will wind up with some potential, some electrical potential, which will be equilibrium potential, and it will be there forever. Remarkable, isn't it? Who would have thought that? So I find it remarkable, number one, that Walter Nernst in 1888 figured this out. And then I also find it remarkable that the brain figured out how to work this way, too, because this is how it creates an electrical signal. So to see how that works, let's just, as almost a sort of thought experiment, if you want to play with this later, you can have a copy here. Let's imagine that these channels, instead of being permeable to potassium, are permeable only to sodium. So now we flip things around. So now the potassium can't move, but the sodium can. So qualitatively, if you go through it very quickly, you can see what would happen. The sodium now sees there's much less sodium inside, so it's going to rush in through these channels, and more sodium is going to go inside. But as it does that, there are going to be fewer uncovered anions. And so the membrane potential is going to get more positive in here. And at some point, it's going to get too positive for more sodium ions to come in, because, you know, like charges do out. And so even though sodium is very high outside and very low inside, and by chemical diffusion, the sodium would like to move in, because the membrane potential now, the voltage inside here, has gotten to be more positive, sodium ions find a barrier to doing so. And so if you took this very same equation and now just changed the numbers of the concentrations, you would instead get an equilibrium potential for sodium of about plus 50 millivolts. Now, this could be just a touch confusing, because notice we've done something tricky here. We've gotten a negative membrane potential by being selectively permeable to potassium. We've got a positive membrane potential by being selectively permeable to sodium. So we have a negative membrane potential and a positive membrane potential, but we're only using positive ions. So that may seem a little bit unintuitive at first. But it's because they're asymmetrically distributed in this way across the membrane. So for sodium, it reaches an equilibrium potential when the cell is plus 50 millivolts inside. That means there's too much charge inside for another sodium ion to get in, another sodium ion to get in. Now what? The Z is plus 1, yes. How do I know what? That's just by convention. So we always do one with respect to the other. And so by convention, it's this way. I mean, it could be otherwise. We could, you know, tell you. I don't know what I should say. So one time, the convention was the other way. You have to blame Benjamin Franklin for this. But that's a history class. So Franklin thought electricity was carried by positive charges rather than the electrons that actually carried them. And so all the conventions were wrong for many years, and they had to be reversed. In fact, some of the early physiological literature has it just the opposite way. But it's just by convention. Yes, so that's why this is negative, right? So if the concentration outside the cell, isn't that right? So if the concentration, no, he's right, you're wrong. The concentration outside the cell, if this is a fraction. Less than one, then that's going to be a negative number. The logarithm is a negative number, right? So if this is less than one, you'll wind up with a negative number. More than one, you have a positive. Right? Yes. How do you? Right. So we're going to do that right now. I'll check this afterwards to make sure. I think that's correct. Okay, so when we actually put an electrode in a real cell, we find that it has a stable membrane potential, which we call the resting membrane potential. Here, if we do this, it has something called the resting membrane potential, which is something called RMV. Sometimes just called B sub N, but that's not as good. So we'll call it resting membrane potential. And that tends to be about minus 70 or so millivolts. Minus 70, minus 75, it varies from cell to cell type. So minus 70 millivolts is, of course, neither minus 90 nor plus 50. So it's not really at either equilibrium potential, but it's somewhere in between them, a little closer to potassium's equilibrium potential than sodium's. And so the way this appears to come about is that these cells have a couple of kinds of channels, and some of them are potassium selective and some of them are sodium selective. At resting membrane potential, with a cell at rest where it's just not doing anything, there tends to be more potassium channels open and available than sodium channels. There are a fair number of potassium channels open, so-called leak channels, because they stay open all the time. These are potassium channels. And then a few sodium channels that are open as well, allowing both processes to go on at once. And so the cell finds some place where winds up at a stable resting membrane potential. Now, I should point out this is not an equilibrium. It's sometimes called a steady state, which is a different physical idea, a different physical idea, but it's not importantly an equilibrium. It would run down because it's neither at minus 90 or at plus 50. So what's happening is at minus 70 millivolts, potassium ions are still happy to get out, and sodium ions are still happy to get in. But they tend to do it on a one-to-one trade. So every time a potassium ion pops out, the sodium ion pops in. And so you get this steady state of minus 70 millivolts. But if you go away for a few hours, that will eventually run down. Because, of course, little by little, potassium is going out and sodium is going in, and you're going to lose your concentration gradient. And so at some point, the chemical part of this equation won't work anymore because C2 will equal C1 for both ions. And there'll be no membrane. It'll be dead. It'll be all dead. But we don't have to worry about that one. It's a physiology. So this is not an equilibrium potential. That's important to recognize. It's in between two equilibrium potentials. And that's how you arrive at this resting membrane potential. So there's a sort of important little trick in here, and I won't be able to get too far into it. But take a minute to make sure that I actually said everything I want to say. All right, so you know that this happens with ion channels. We've had some talk about ion channels. And these ion channels are proteins that get stuck in the membrane and have certain specific kinds of characteristics to them. They are, first of all, as we've talked about, selective. There are potassium ion channels and sodium ion channels and calcium ion channels, and they have all sorts of cute molecular devices that we're beginning to know about now that allow one or the other ion to go through, but not both. There are some channels that don't select. They'll let any positive ion through, but no negative ion. And some channels are good for chloride, but no positive ion. The whole mix and match kind of thing going on. But in general, the ones we're interested in are selective to either potassium or sodium. And they maintain that selectivity. So that's one thing that ion channels do, is selectivity. Selective for particular ions. They have something called a conductance. The conductance is a measure of how easily that ion can pass. So some of them are kind of small, like these leak channels, and they just let potassium through very slowly, literally one ion at a time. Other ones can be quite big and support a fairly significant flow of ions through them. So they have a conductance that's different from channel to channel. It depends on how big the hole is and how well it's built and all sorts of other things. And finally, they're what's called gated. By gated, I mean that they're not always open or always closed, but they can go back and forth, and they can go rapidly back and forth between the two. You can think of them as operating almost like a shutter on a camera. So they're normally closed, and then they can come open, and then they can close again. And there are various things that cause them to come open or close. And among those things are voltage. The major ones, so they can be sensitive to voltage. At a certain membrane voltage, they'll open. At other membrane voltages, they're closed. Or chemicals. This will become important when we talk about synapses. And in some cases, just pressure. For example, osmotic pressure or touch or things like that. The important ones we're going to talk about are voltage and time. And for the moment, voltage are going to be the ones we're interested in. So what we call voltage-gated ion channels. Alright, so what's the magic trick? As well. The magic trick is up here. So far, what I've told you is that information in these cells is translated in some ways into voltage, that neurons are electrochemical machines that create voltage across their membrane, and that this voltage can be a proxy, if you will, for the information that comes in, whether it's light or sound or touch or anything else, in the brain. This is how information is transferred. It's changed into a membrane voltage and then moved around. So that's okay as long as you can change the voltage in response to the signal. But so far all we have is an equilibrium potential, or an equilibrium voltage, and a resting membrane potential, which all sound kind of quiet and boring, but nothing happens. So somehow or another, you have to be able to change this voltage in response to a stimulus. And the way we do this is what you get it in So the way neurons do this is they create something called an action potential. Yet another potential, but this just means voltage. I think you have on your handout a picture of an action potential, which I'll go over next time. But basically, an action potential, if you're making a recording, and here's membrane voltage over here, and this is time over here in milliseconds, let's say, and here's, let's call this minus 70, that's the resting membrane potential, then what you get is something that looks like this. This is about plus 20 millivolts up here. You can see that. Plus 20 millivolts there. 70, so zero is somewhere in there. What you get is this spike of voltage. This whole thing lasts maybe 2 milliseconds tops. So it's very fast, and it's a sudden, rapid, transient change in the voltage. Where you're sitting at the resting membrane potential, you get a little bit of the voltage was a little bit positive, and then it hits this sort of threshold point. And suddenly you get a huge discharge, a huge change in the voltage, where it goes very positive, plus 20 millivolts, and then just as quickly comes way back down, even below the resting potential, and finally back to the resting membrane potential. And this is called an action potential. And action potentials are kind of the coin of the realm in the brain. So the way cells communicate, the way they move information around, is by generating these action potentials. So again, almost everything you know in the world has been translated into an action potential of some sort. What's remarkable is they're invariant. By invariant, I mean they're almost always the same time course, and they're usually the same size. So every action potential that you produce in your brain looks pretty much like this one. There are little differences, but pretty much like this one. So how can that encode information? The way you do it is produce action potentials. Well, there are essentially two ways that you do this. There are two ways you do this. So one is with frequency. The stronger a stimulus, the stronger a signal, the more frequently you make these action potentials. So a nerve cell can generate them at rates up to 1,000 times per second. That's very high, but it can be anywhere from 1 or 2 per second to 1,000 times per second. And so the stronger the stimulus, the more action potentials you fire off. The other thing is the pathway during which these action potentials travel, and that's what tells you the quality of the stimulus. So if an action potential is coming from your retina down your optic nerve into the visual areas of your brain, which happen to be in the back, then it's going to be translated as a visual experience. If on the other hand it's coming from the cells in your ear and it goes in the eighth nerve, which is the auditory nerve, and plugs into the side of your brain, you will interpret it as a sound experience. So I know that sounds ridiculous, but it's true. So in point of fact, if you could take and do the actually this experiment's been done with ferrets, believe it or not, you're in ferrets, but imagine this experiment. If you could take your optic nerve and your auditory nerve and unplug them, switch them around so that the optic nerve went to the auditory cortex and the auditory nerve went to the optic cortex, you would, as they say, see thunder and hear lightning. I know that sounds incredibly improbable to you, but I'll finish off today with a very simple experiment that will absolutely prove it to you. Alright? So you need to listen to my instructions about doing everything. What I want you to do is pair up with the person next to you. Okay, you have to do this together. Alright? And what you're going to do is, the person sitting to the right, is going to make a fist and slug the other person in the eye as hard as you can. Alright? Ready? One. All right. We'll make it a thought experiment. So you can imagine what will happen. If you get slugged in the eye, of course you'll feel pain because there are pain receptors all around you, but we're not interested in that. But what you'll get, however, is a flash of light, right? I mean, if you're banged in the eye hard enough, you see a flash of light. Why do you see a flash of light? Because the photoreceptors in your eye are most sensitive to photons. That's what really triggers them off, of course, light. But any energy strong enough will cause them to fire. And so in the case of a good punch in the eye, you're using mechanical energy, and the mechanical energy is strong enough to actually make some of the photoreceptor cells in your eye fire off action potentials. And those action potentials just go down the optic nerve, back to your brain, and you go, whoa, that was a bright light there, that was a flash. Because, of course, there's no scene in there, there's no resolution, there's no detail in it, it's just a flash of light. But nonetheless, your brain interprets it as a flash of light, not as a punch or something. I mean, eventually you figure out it's a punch. And so it's pathway specific. All right, and next time I'll tell you how we get these action potentials to fire off. Thank you.
Activity for ion channels has to do with the size of the ion?
Not entirely. entirely, but some of it is, so, yes.
Because then wouldn't the KV channels leak the sodium as well?
Well, so, yes. So, I mean, to some extent, there's a size thing. So, for example, sodium ions are smaller than potassium ions.
Right.
And so you could imagine you could make a small channel, and then only sodium ions could get through it. But then why don't they go through the bigger potassium channel, right? And so it's more, it gets to be more common. The thing about a sodium ion is, for example, just to give a quick explanation. So sodium ion is smaller, but because it's smaller, it collects a lot of water molecules around it because it's positively charged, and the negative oxygens in the water sort of, and so it has what's called a hydration shell. And in order to get through that ion channel, it has to shed those molecules of water, and that takes a lot of energy. And so some channels are constructed so they have little positive charges around their rim, so the water molecules will attach to them, and then the sodium can slip through. But it can't get through a potassium channel, because even though the ion is smaller, the ion plus the water is bigger. So there are a lot of tricks like that. I mean, it's very clever stuff. But evolution had a long time to play with. But yeah, so it's not just size. It's size plus certain characteristics.
So the negative seven available potassium potential takes into account all the different ions and their negative potential equation. So if you were to do like theoretically solve the Hawking potential equations with less chlorine, with just potassium and sodium, I basically have a question. I did solve it, and anyway, this is just like setting the
right, okay.
Initial membrane potential to negative.
Okay.
And then I'm just confused why the resting potential goes levels out about negative 10.
I don't know. Obviously, it shouldn't.
Yeah.
But I don't, I mean, I don't, it's too hard for me to get through this whole thing right now. So I don't know. Are you using, but it shouldn't have anything to do with chloride. You should be able to get this with just, you should, yes, at least in theory, because chloride just redistributes itself in that model, which is largely true. So I don't know why you have this.
Right.
I mean, clearly that's fine,
yeah.
But it should go back here. Now, why do you have it at minus 50 as a resting membrane potential? That's a little high.
I just put it as the initial voltage. So this is under, this is the initial voltage. And,
I see it all.
This is like the strength and duration of the pulse one would give to the, neuron.
I mean, everything that I can see quickly looks okay.
I checked it over,
but I don't know exactly what. Who are you doing this for?
You or with somebody?
I was doing this for me, and then I'm also taking Julio Fernandez's class.
Sure, it's cool.
Yeah, I'm going to. I just didn't know if there's something.
He should be able to figure that out. I can't see it. I just quickly, I can't see what it is.
Okay.
It's subtle, whatever it is.
Okay.
It's interesting, but it's subtle.
Yeah. Hi, a couple other questions.
Yeah.
Are those the concentrations before you go in the room, or are they imaginary non-resting potential?
No, those are those concentrations are what actually exist in you.
Okay.
Now, how they get that way is, I'm sure you need energy to pump, so you have pumps of various sorts to pump the ions across, against their concentration gradient.
So, but that's at resting potential, though, or is it before? Like, when we created resting potential, I wasn't sure if those were the initial concentrations or the equilibrium concentrations.
I'm not sure you're asking the right question.
Okay.
So, I mean, these are actually the concentrations that exist. If you have a permeability to only one ion, then those concentrations will give you that equilibrium concentration, that equilibrium potential.
Okay.
If you have a permeability to multiple ions, then those concentrations will give you the resting membrane.
Oh, okay, that's... Yeah, I
see what I mean?
It,
okay.
Yeah.
It just depends on the selectivity.
Gotcha. So the permeability. C1 and C2 that you plug in were not the neither.
Yeah, I think they are.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, I think if you plug those numbers in, you'll get minus 90 and plus 50.
Okay.
Or something very close to it.
Okay.
I may have them off by a couple million dollars.
Right.
But you should get them, yeah.
And then the other question is, so how does the body maintain the steady state of
Well, yes, so you have to pump. You have a. We'll get to that next time. You have to pump the ions back across the membrane and maintain. So it takes energy. That's why we need it.
Got it.
Otherwise, you're right, you're dead.
Got it. Thanks.
So people who have synesthesia, is it because their synapses are made on the wrong pathways?
So nobody knows for sure why it is. I mean, I think the commonly held theory is that early in development we have a lot more, almost 30% more neurons than you do even by the time you're 6 or 8 months old. And many of them die away, so there's a pruning thing. So you overmake what you need, and then when you actually get to see the world, you prune things back. And there's several programs, developmental programs and environmental interactions that do this. And the thought is that in synesthesia, maybe some of that pruning back doesn't occur. So that some of the connections between, say, auditory and color are left where they should be removed. And so people have this extra sense about it.
Like babies, like in the first few months, probably have different sensory...
Could very well be. All babies could be synesthetes. I don't know. That I don't know, because you can't ask them. You know, they don't talk. That's the problem. But that's the current idea. I mean, I can't tell you for sure how good the data is on that.